Testing, testing.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Who do we appreciate? Yeah, is that real live?
Yeah.
The mic? Because I tend to be rather soft spoken.
Yeah, I think.
But I carry two big sticks. Okay. Actually, kind of little sticks. Seven D's. Seven A's.
Do you have another set of headphones, or can I just check the sound of these? I'm sure it's fine, but this camera that we're using doesn't have the levels showing on it. I got it. It's the same type of camera, but it's different than what we've been using. Figure it out real quick.
You know, when I made that CD I gave you, man, that was kind of grueling because the mic was so lively, like when I swallowed or, you know, turned a page or burped or something, it picked everything up. So
yeah.
we had to keep doing things over and over again. But I've discovered since then that shouldn't be necessary. You can edit all that stuff out later, you know. One of the drummers that subs for me, he's got some very professional recording equipment that he's left right at the house there with me now. So I can use that at my leisure for voice recording, you know. And he used to do that for a living. So he recorded people like Earl Nightingale and Deepak Chopra and guys like that.
Just for your own records, these tapes are all numbered. Number one to the CDs are numbered 1 to 150, and they're actually numbered from 1 to 418. But we only have enough money to do the first 150, which produced those 300 CDs. So some tapes required 2 or 3 CDs, you know, to get everything on it. The first one we're starting with is number 6.
Okay.
Just so you'll know if you ever need to refer to it. This tape, what Smith wrote on the label, it's the only information we have, is Smith wrote Zoot, Greenwell, Free, Takas, McKenna. And then he wrote good music and a good recording. And that's all we have to go about.
Okay.
So you could listen to this and you could go, that's not me, you know, or something. You know, it's possible.
So he was my name on it?
Yeah.
Thank you. here to base it on. Found a new baby, maybe, or I'm not sure yet. No, that's not it. Thank you. That beat don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Yeah. I haven't really changed that much. When was this?
This one was not dated, but it was probably either 1960, early 1960, or 59. My guess.
All right, I guess. I wasn't too thrilled with it. Still sounded like me. Is there some more cuts from that same session?
Yeah. There's also getting ready to be some in-between songs.
Chatter?
Yeah, this might be something. You know, you might need headphones for it, but we'll see. First tune, you thought it was Freddie first and then Zoot?
Yeah.
What about here?
I think that's Freddie too, I believe.
Recognize the tune?
Preacher. Isn't that the name of it?
Yeah.
there, Cizu? Play. He goes all out, man. He just puts that horn in his mouth.
Well,
that's a group, huh?
I've seen pictures of some good ones with Smith.
Yeah, he had some good shots, yeah. You don't have to stop it. We can just talk over.
I mean, does this ring any bells?
Not specifically, just some general bells, you know. I don't remember this particular session, but there were so many of them, you know, they all the time.
What about, like, in this tune here, when McKenna was playing, you could hear people talking and stuff in the background?
Oh, that was typical, yeah. I couldn't make out what was being said. I wasn't focused on it, but maybe with earphones I could hear something, but probably nothing important. Sounded like Zoot.
You want to play it back and let's do it in headphones?
Yeah. But as far as my playing is concerned, it's okay. Yeah. I've heard it all. I've heard it all thousands of times. It's hard to be objective. I'll be interested in hearing Roy when he sits in just to see if there's any dramatic contrast, you know. I remember the night Roy was at. I only remember one night when he came up, but he might have been there other nights when I wasn't. I don't know. Dave, I guess. I think that was me. Song, you mean? Deep Purple.
Deep Purple?
Yeah.
Is that Freddie on sax?
No, I think that's Zoot. Zoot gets a little sweeter tone, you know. Freddie's tone was a little funkier, I guess, a little gravelier or something. Zoot saying, yeah. Thank you. so good. Are you familiar with the third hand syndrome in the piano players?
No.
Certain piano players that you can listen to, and you could swear you heard a third hand in there, that it's impossible to do what they're doing with just two hands. And McKenna's always doing stuff like that. And Dave, the guy that lives downstairs from me that works at the hotel, he's got a bunch of McKenna things, and he's just, man, he just doesn't know how he does all these things, man. It's just phenomenal.
What's Dave's name?
Morrison.
Who's the guy that I met when I was up there?
Probably Dave, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Wears glasses, not very tall.
You know, I think but I've got a whole lot of questions I'd like to ask.
Go ahead. Ask them anytime they come up.
Okay, I'm just trying to think of, you know, maybe one of the things we can do while you're here is, I mean, I'd like for you to, you know, comment on whatever comes to mind, you know, as we're listening to these. And then I have, you know, questions. I mean, some of the stuff I already know, but I would like to ask you again, you know, some of the things, you know, that you told me before about how you found this loft and you know, some of the background information. But I wonder, maybe I should save those kinds of questions for either, like, we could go up in the library where there's some couches, you know, and set mm-hmm. up there and just talk, you know, more casually
mm-hmm.
about the loft in general. Or, you know, I'd really like to get up actually with Dan to Hot Springs sometime, you know, and do some videotaping of you talking about this up there. So some part of me says, you know, I'd like to wait and, like, ask you some of those pointed questions, you know, then when you're up there. But I don't know how it's gonna work. But
yeah, I keep a set of drums down in set up down in the room there too, you know, we could have access to if need be.
Yeah, see, that'd be cool.
My Yamahas.
Yeah, you said you had two sets now, right?
Yeah, I got a set of Gretsch that I leave at the hotel, and then this little hip gig set that Al Foster designed. They're Yamahas. All the drums telescope into the bass drum when you pack them up.
Yeah.
Bass drum's about this long, 22 inches long, 18 by 22.
Dan, if you ever have any questions that come to mind.
Yes,
speak
right up.
What kind of drums did you have in the loft?
Gretsch.
And they were just sitting there all the time? Or?
I think they were my drums. They might have met somebody else might have had some drums at times. You know what I can't remember? That was like on the fourth or fifth floor, man. And I don't remember hauling those drums up and down those steps because there was no elevator. And the trap case is heavy, man. So I don't remember if I did that by myself or if I had help with it or.
But you had your drums just set up there for an extended period, right?
Yeah, well. Plus I had gigs or something. I only had one set, so if I had gigs, I had to pack them up and take them to the gig. And so sometimes if I was working, somebody else might bring some drums up. And I don't remember ever playing anybody else's drums there, but it might have happened. Mine were there usually. Sometimes after the gig, you know, I'd haul them back and set them up again and keep going.
Is this a fun experience for you to listen to this?
Yeah, I'm enjoying it. Yeah. it's you know, yeah, it's great. Yeah, well, Dave was, you know, he could play the shit out of that kind of, you know, stride piano. Matter of fact, I don't know if I mentioned this to you, but, you know, the Musician's Bar, the Charlie's Bar, right around the corner from the Union Hall. And Union days were like Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. On Roseland Ballroom, the Union Hall would, Musicians Union would have their meetings right out there. And it'd be swarming with musicians, and they'd be giving out club dates and so forth on the floor. And then they'd all, or a bunch of the jazz guys particularly, would head for Charlie's Bar afterwards. And the jukebox had things like Horace Silver and Art Blakey and the Messengers, and Dave McKenna had an album on the jukebox, and it got more played than anything. It was just a single, just Dave McKenna, man. And I hardly ever went in there when somebody wasn't playing Dave's stuff, man. But he was a hard drinker, man, but he could still play. There are nights where he'd just be hanging at the piano and still rollicking right along. You know? I don't remember ever really having any conversations with him, per se. You know, we didn't do a lot of talking. We just played. You know, they did a lot of talking while we were playing, you know, but I'd be playing all the time. And
yeah.
Horn players would get to chat and so forth. And between.
What would Eugene Smith be doing?
Probably, at his little work table, you know, looking at negatives and I don't know what all he did there, man. He was always busy doing something. And he had a work table, you know, with all kinds of pictures and negatives. And
how did it come about that you ended up basically living in his loft, right? How did that happen?
Damn if I remember. just playing so many sessions there, you know, that I don't remember ever really asking him, you know, it just kind of happened. I just wound up sleeping in one of his recliners there, you know.
Last week there was a woman here from the University of Arizona, you know, and they have all this stuff. When he died, everything he owned was deposited out there, including two recliners.
My old recliner. I bet it's one of them. How about that?
Thank you.
think I'll go Spring Nugget out and bring him over if that's okay.
Sure.
Let him out for a minute.
Okay.
Also be cool. One thing I'd love to do is to maybe get Tom in here for one session. Somebody who's completely unfamiliar with Ron and hasn't really interviewed anybody. And just to see what kind of questions he would ask.
Right.
Completely fresh.
Should I be leaving this on for the whole song, or?
Probably not. I think.
I did it first, but I think.
Yeah. I think I want to be the same way with the dad tape. I don't know if there's any reason, that at the end of this week, I have 20 hours of tape of him just sitting there listening.
Right.
But it's good to have some stuff. This is pretty cool. And even that dog are so tight. When I was up visiting him, it was amazing. That dog, Nugget, knew like where they were going in the car by where, like if Ron turned the blinker to turn at a certain intersection in a certain direction, Nugget would know exactly where they were going. And if it was somewhere that he liked, he would like start jumping up and down and barking and shit. It was amazing.
calm down, Nugget.
Nugget, come here. Hey, come here. Come over here. Hey, Nugget. Come here, leave Sam alone. Come here. Come over here. Dave, or they might have just gone out to get something to drink and coming back, who knows?
They go out to like bars or different places?
Depends on what time it was, I guess. Of course, bars were open till 4 o'clock. So. Sometimes these went on till daylight. Had enough for a while?
Well, let's see, what time is it? 4?
It's only 5 after 4, yeah.
All right, let's think about it now. Dan, do you want to go to the game?
It sounds good, yeah.
Okay. Let's just plan the next few hours. I think in order to leave the game, in order to get to the game, you can go park at your place. We'll just swing by and pick you up. We'll just come behind you, you know, just a couple minutes after you. And so if we leave here, at 8, that'll give us time to go by, pick you up, get to the place where we're parking, and walk down to the arena.
Yeah, you can tell me where the store is, and I can go do some little grocery thing now.
Okay. What do you want to do for dinner? Is there anything? There's a good Mexican.
What are you going to do?
Well, I just want to go. We could all go out to eat somewhere. There's a good Mexican place close by.
Mexican sounds good to me.
You want to just do Blue Corn?
Sure, yeah, that's good.
Okay. So the grocery store gets pretty crowded, like after 5. So it might be a good idea if you want to go do that now. And then we'll meet back here, listen to another CD, another tape, before we're going to dinner.
Okay.
So we could meet back here in this room at 5 o'clock.
Okay. So where's the store?
Well, there's a really nice Whole Foods store, which is fancy, you know. They have a lot of fresh baked muffins and shit like that. And you know, cooked food. They have like a deli and cafe kind of thing that you could buy, you know, prepared food.
Great. I'll probably be going there quite a bit.
Yeah, and you can walk there almost. We walk there all the time from here for lunch.
Maybe I'll put a leash on him and we'll walk up there because he needs a little exercise anyhow.
Yeah. I think they allow dogs in there.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
If not, I can tie him up out front or something.
But so you go back out here to Swift, mm-hmm. and instead of taking a left to go back out to the highway like you did when you came in, you go right.
Across
the tracks, and it's in the grocery store is actually at that intersection in a strip just on the other side of the stoplight.
What's the name of it?
It's called Whole Foods.
Is there a sign out there or something?
Yeah. And so if you cross the railroad tracks and go through the stoplight, it's just immediately on the left. So we'll come back, and at 5, we'll listen to another tape,
yeah.
And then we'll go to dinner, and then we'll go to the Hoos game.
Yeah, man, we got a plan.
Yeah.
Did you play any ball?
The artistry of Roy Haynes, the genius of Roy Haynes, what really set him apart 50 years ago, and I believe still sets him apart today, is his uncanny ability to play completely free music while still keeping a natural beat or a natural rhythm or a natural swing to a tune. Haynes has one of the most unique and recognizable sounds in all of American music, but he doesn't use that sound for his own self-expression. He uses it to engage in a dialogue with his fellow musicians. His sound is almost like a trampoline off of which his fellow musicians leap and then come back down. He actually catches them. His ability to listen and hear and figure out where these musicians are allows him to actually catch them and propel them at the same time. Natural rhythm. And he can do that better than really anybody that I believe. Haynes is really a bundle of beautiful contradictions. He has one of the most recognizable, instantly recognizable drum sounds in all of music. Yet his greatest work affects the listeners and his fellow musicians subliminally. Haynes is looking for a dialogue. He's looking to engage his fellow musicians in a dialogue. He's not out there for himself to make a bunch of bombastic noises. He's out there to play music and create a dialogue with everybody on stage. And in doing so, he lifts them up to a higher level. Haynes' pedigree in the music is really almost unmatched. He goes back all the way to the mid-40s with Lester Young and then Charlie Parker, Bud Powell, Sarah Vaughan, Thelonious Monk, John Coltrane. But the amazing thing about Roy Haynes is that today, at age 78, he's still out there on the edge. He's still playing as well as he ever has, and I believe as well as any drummer ever has today.
True, you know. Sounds trite, but that's literally what it was. And it was thrilling, you know, to be playing with those guys. I wished all my friends at home could see me, and you know, that sort of thing. Just matter of fact, some of them did come up and move to New York, a couple of friends, and used to hang out in the lofts. And
yeah.
Got to know a lot of the guys. But I was still very much a kid, you know. I was retarded for my age, actually, emotionally and psychologically, because of my home life situation. So I was working through a lot of that pain. You know, a lot of it wasn't all fun because it was music gets right to the heart of things sometimes, and it's not always comfortable.
The music's not comfortable.
Well, some of the emotional things that you go through in the process of playing and learning and growing. Mm-hmm. Adjusting. I was literally learning on the spot, so to speak. You know, I had pitifully little experience when I arrived in New York, and even my exposure to various artists was very limited. You know, my father had a bunch of 78s that I used to listen to, jazz at the Philharmonic and things like that. But most of these guys I only knew from reading about them in Downbeat or maybe heard a record here and there that they were on. So for a while it was each one of these quote unquote big time players that I played with, it was like another notch in my belt, so to speak. You know? I was a small southern town homeboy that was dazzled by the bright lights in the big city. And a lot of it was surreal, you know, especially when I started doing a lot of drugs and all. Instead of a dream come true, it was literally like a dream. It was dreamlike.
What age were you when you started doing the drugs?
Well, I had a few little encounters with drugs, you know, from the time I was maybe 16, but it didn't really get out of hand till I moved to New York and was trying to hang with the big boys. So I guess I was about 20, 21 when I first started really heading down that dismal path.
And you were in New York by that age, right?
Yeah, I was 18 or 19 when I arrived there. I think I was arrived there around Christmas time, and so I think I was 18, and then I turned 19 January 15th.
So on a night like this, with these guys we're just listening to, would you have been smoking pot, or what would your normal night look like, do you think?
Oh, we would have probably smoked some pot, yeah. And I was probably popping amphetamines and God knows what all. I never really saw any smack in the loft scenes. If anybody was doing anything, they were doing it privately, you know. But generally speaking, smack and jam sessions don't particularly mix anyhow, because, you know, you get stoned on smack and you don't want to do anything but sit around and nod, read the same paragraph in a book over and over again. But pot tends to somehow stir the creative juices, you know, makes you feel like playing, and you hear things differently, changes your perspective. And of course, speed just gives you the energy. And we probably swilling a few beers or drinking wine or something along with it.
What kind of beer do you remember?
Probably, you know, standard Budweiser's or something like that. Back then you didn't see a lot of imports and all like that.
Some of the pictures I've noticed from Rheingold.
Could be. I don't even remember Rheingold. I don't know. I was probably in my youth, all beer tasted the same to me.
Yeah.
All American beer. And I'm reminded of a Monty Python line. I don't know if I ever told you this or not, from a Monty Python movie. A guy said, American beer is like making love in a canoe. I said, what do you mean by that? He said, it's fucking close to water. So I didn't really get to appreciate real beer until much later in life. Heineken's and Dos Equis. Canadians make some pretty good beer. And Americans make some pretty good beer now, Samuel Adams, and there's a few varieties. Ice beers taste a lot better than, I don't know what the process is, why it tastes different, but it's a lot more flavorful to me.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to mark the time on this CD, 2014 in the ring. I think you probably should pack this stuff up.
Yeah, this takes about out. It's going to be a false count on that. I thought it had 63 minutes on it.